Hello, dear listeners. This is Dr. Mahjubeen Islam.
And I'm Dr. Ketley Daniels.
It's a joy for Dr. Daniels and me to have you join us for this podcast. Many of you have been with us through this journey of understanding addictive disorders. At the start of our series, we concentrated on substances that were addictive, and we have now progressed to what we call behavioral addictions. In eating disorders, a person is either addicted to thinness or to food or other substances that they eat. And while this episode will help with providing information about anorexia nervosa, should you or someone you can help have this diagnosis, do contact your primary care physician for the necessary evaluation and treatment. So eating disorders are characterized by persistent disturbance of eating behavior that impairs health or psychosocial functioning.
You know, I was the medical director of the St. Vincent Medical Center's eating disorder program, and I can tell you this is one of the more challenging disorders to treat.
It is.
And it has a high rate of morbidity and mortality, a lot more than a lot of the other psychiatric illnesses. But there are many predisposing factors, including genes. Of course, we know that because they have found that in some families, you have several family members who do have eating disordered behaviors. Sociocultural pressures are very, very prominent. Imagine in our culture especially, there was a time, I think the model's name was Twiggy.
Twiggy.
Everyone wanted to be like Twiggy.
Yes.
You know, this was many years ago.
I
think we just dated ourselves.
Yeah,
right?
Indeed, yes. But that's okay. It is what it is.
It is what it is, yeah. Right? The pressure to be a certain size, a certain weight, the dietary restraints, exercising, over-exercising, family history of eating disordered behaviors, even if it's not diagnosed. So, for example, in our family, when my girls were getting older, early teens, mid-teens, and they were gaining weight, I didn't harp on it. I didn't discuss, you know, going on a diet. I simply changed the way I fed them. And we went from a large dinner plate to a smaller plate. I did what I could to help them without frankly focusing on it, as in some families where some children are browbeaten because of their weight. And then, of course, they have found that childhood maltreatment, mistreatment are associated with eating disordered behaviors.
Yeah, adverse childhood experiences, mm-hmm. which is so common in so many disorders of addiction.
Mm-hmm.
We noticed that in adults, the prevalence, the general lifetime prevalence is 0.8%. And it's more common in females than males. And when we go on to the other eating disorders, we will see that the opposite pole of overeating or binge eating disorder is commoner than anorexia nervosa.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, the anorexics, about 1% of the population may experience it in women, whereas 0.3% in men are afflicted with this issue. And it's important for us as clinicians to screen for it. But one of the things I've noticed that often, just like other chemical uses, the patients do not willingly share the information. So we have to screen for it. We have to have an index of suspicion, as we call it. If they have adverse childhood experiences, if they have a history of trauma, women, transgender individuals, athletes, and those with anxiety and depression, rigid personalities, perfectionism, all those things are to trigger our thoughts. And some things we ask about their weight, if it changes back and forth. Do they use diuretics? Are they one to use laxatives? Do they have purging behaviors? When they work out, how long do you work out? Some people actually, so I'll screen in my social history and ask if what their diet is like. Do they exercise? But sometimes I don't ask unless something triggers a thought. How long do you exercise? Well, if it's 2 or 3 hours, mm-hmm. that's a little bit extreme.
Exactly.
Okay. And also, we do have the SCOF questionnaire that is available, although most of us do not use that in psychiatry. But in the questionnaire, you ask them, do you make yourself sick because you feel uncomfortably full? Do you worry about losing control of how much you eat? That would be the C. Have you recently lost more than one stone, that's a 14-pound weight, in a three-month period? Do you believe yourself to be fat when others say you are thin? Would you say that food dominates your life? And I remember one of the women we worked with way back when at St. V's, and I, I clearly see her running down Monroe in the middle of the afternoon as I was driving down the street. I saw her running, and she was emaciated, but yet in her mind, she was still...
Yeah, the distorted body image. Body dysmorphia.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And so if they answer two or more questions, yes, to this, then you know that there is likely something that you need to pursue. And the neurobiology tells us also that there are altered structures, abnormal functioning in the circuitry of the brain associated with this disorder. And then hunger begins to not be acknowledged. Sometimes they used to say that anorexics, they're not hungry, but that's really not a fact. They can ignore the hunger cues.
Right.
That's what happens with them. And there are deficits in the dopaminergic system and the serotonergic system.
Yeah, and that's, you know, we've now joined serotonin to our favorite chemical, dopamine. So it's playing a role in this disorder. Both of them are playing a role. And the core clinical feature in anorexia nervosa, or what we like to call addicted to thinness, is a persistent restriction of energy intake. And they have an abnormally low body weight. So that's one. Then the second piece is that they have an intense fear of gaining weight or becoming fat. And the third is, which Lady Diana, Princess Diana had, the distorted perception and or the importance of body weight and shape, which you just mentioned, you know, body dysmorphia. And there are associated features as well. The common ones, or the prominent ones, are this relentless pursuit of thinness, an obsessional preoccupation with food. And you would look at this person who is underweight, markedly underweight, but they have this obsessional preoccupation with food. And then there's a fear of certain foods, a restricted repertoire of foods. And the secrecy is a very important thing. And this is seen in both overeating and binge eating disorders, as well as in anorexia or restricted food intake, in which there is, they are very secretive about eating and will not eat in public or with the family. They will eat, like, you know, passing by, go in the kitchen and hide about it. And then the limited insight into or denial of the core clinical features. So they don't really see themselves the way that others see them or what they factually are. And then there is this inflexibility and perfectionism. These are features that are associated with anorexia nervosa.
It's interesting. I remember there was a case that I was consulted on at the hospital, and they were concerned that this woman had anorexia because of her thinness and her refusal to eat. And when I went into the room, her eyes gave it away that she was not anorexic. Rather, she was psychotic. But they can present, you know, I mean, anyone can present with this group of symptoms. But you have to really, and as I talked with her and talked further, I discovered that she was indeed psychotic, and we had to transfer to the psychiatric unit. But she was quite thin, and it was more paranoia that was keeping her from eating rather than a body image issue. It was a very interesting case.
Yeah, this overlap, and that just tells you that, you know, good history taking and physical exam are so important instead of rushing in. And sadly, our medical system has become this way, that, you know, 5 minutes per patient.
Sad. It really makes me sad, because the best way we as physician can make a diagnosis is through the clinical interview. Everything else supports the interview. But if you don't have time to really talk to the patient, You will miss so much.
Or if your only time that you have is to throw tests at them.
Right.
Yeah.
It's such a waste of money.
That is a very sad thing.
Such a waste of money.
Yeah, but, and very, very prevalent.
Yeah, I feel bad for those who are coming after us, because I so enjoy practicing medicine, but it's changing. It has changed, I should say. There are many other mood disorders and psychiatric illnesses that come in and walk hand in hand with anorexia, including major depression. And sometimes it's like the chicken or the egg, but depression is associated with it. Anxiety is associated with it. Obsessive compulsive disorders. And it's almost ritualistic how some of the people in the program used to eat, because we had lunch with them. And they would play with their food and move it around as if they're eating it, but they really were not consuming
the food. Yeah.
But the body dysmorphia, and I don't want anyone out there thinking just because you think your belly is a little bit, you know, bigger than you want it to be, or your hips are too full or too thin, it doesn't mean you have body dysmorphia. These are people who actually see themselves as overweight when in reality they are underweight, or they perceive that, like, what is that, the cat lady who has had so much procedures done on her face that she is, those are, we're talking extremes, not just normal, I need to lose 5 pounds because I want to fit in my skinny bikini this summer or something like that. That's different. And they may be more likely to have PTSD symptoms. Substance abuse is very common, too, in some of these individuals. Impulse control disorders. And the personalities that are associated with it, often one of the highest ones is obsessive compulsive disorder. They can be very rigid and precise. And when I've seen people with their calorie count to the penny, they will count how many calories they're consuming. You may have some avoidant personalities, and the others are also associated, like narcissism and paranoia and borderline, but the two more prevalent ones, the OCD and the avoidant personality. How do you make a diagnosis? Well, you've already touched based on that earlier.
Right, exactly.
And so we know that if they're not eating enough, that's an issue. If they have a fear of gaining weight, that's an issue. Not just, oh, I gained 5 pounds. Oh, my goodness, I don't want to gain 5 pounds. More like, oh, my gosh, my whole world is falling apart. I must lose it. And I'm going to stop and just drink water for the next 5 days. And they will do things like that. And one of the numbers we kept in mind back then, not as much these days, but if they are less than 85% of their ideal body weight, then you know there's something that you should pursue and dig deeper.
Right. And when we come to treatment, this is one disease which is not like hypertension, for instance, in which you can, just the clinician alone is sufficient in most cases. This is something that requires multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary care.
Yes.
And you need a mental health clinician, a dietitian, and a general medical clinician. So the mental health clinician coordinates care among the team members, administers the group therapy, individual, group, and family, and they can provide pharmacotherapy as well, medications. The registered dietitian is a very integral piece here because they provide dietary and nutritional support. They discuss available dietary options, meal planning, nutritional education, and they set appropriate weight goals. And then the general medical clinician, like you just mentioned, an excellent example, we need to rule out other non-psychiatric medical causes of weight loss, mm-hmm. vomiting or menstrual irregularity,
right.
because
right.
people can present with weight loss, they can present with, irregular periods because
right.
that can be a part of eating disorders. But we need to make sure that we make the correct diagnosis
mm-hmm.
and we assess the patient for medical complications. We monitor immediate medical issues like vital signs, electrolyte abnormalities, which is a big piece mm-hmm. in eating disorders, and their hydration status, as well as the longer term issues in terms of bone density, periods, growth issues. And it's really often necessary to check their weight and vital signs on a weekly basis
mm-hmm.
to ensure they're not going into the danger zones.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the treatment setting is concerned, if the person is not medically stable, which can happen in these patients, and it can degenerate pretty quickly, they should be hospitalized for medical stabilization. If they're stable, then it's important to determine the treatment setting with a thorough medical and psychiatric evaluation instead of just compartmentalizing and doing it that way.
But it's so important, though, from what I've experienced in the past, the inpatient setting is the most appropriate, and even if it's in a partial program for a day program, because these individuals are not going to cooperate with refeeding. They have to be monitored very closely. There was an individual who actually was purging, because we monitored them for a whole hour after the eating. She was actually purging later on. She made herself, throw up, and then she was hiding it in the rafters.
Oh.
I know, right? In the rafters, yeah. So they really need close supervision. So the setting is very, very, very crucial.
Yeah, and it's important to customize it to the patient because mm-hmm. of and determine the seriousness of it. Mm-hmm. So in that situation, like you say, hospitalization is important. Mm-hmm. Then you have the partial hospital program or a day program, mm-hmm. and you have an outpatient care, and then residential care may be available. It's really important to use clinical judgment and customizing the treatment. Mm-hmm. And the choice is based upon the severity of the illness as well as underlying or concurrent other medical or psychiatric issues. Mm-hmm. Patients with eating disorders may have serious medical complications and they are at increased risk for suicide or non-suicidal self-injurious behavior. And so psychiatric hospitalization or day treatment programs may be necessary. And like you say, this is a very tough, difficult, obstinate population to deal with. It's just not easy.
I was surprised really to read that in one article they talked about the rate of suicide between the ages of mid-teens to early 20s. It's almost 10 to 12% higher in those with anorexia than the general population for that age group.
Right.
That's significant.
That's huge.
That's significant, yeah.
That really is. The cornerstone of treatment, of course, is nutritional rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. And when we do this nutritional rehabilitation, they frequently resist mm-hmm. refeeding. Mm-hmm. And then in that situation, they require inpatient treatment to promote the weight gain. Mm-hmm. And they have this curious syndrome called refeeding syndrome. And although weight gain is the cornerstone of treatment for patients, restoring weight by refeeding too rapidly can cause this, and it can be potentially fatal.
Correct.
And it's defined as a typical clinical complication that occurs due to fluid and electrolyte shifts mm-hmm. during nutritional rehabilitation of these patients who are significantly malnourished. So estimating the food intake that is needed is very key, mm-hmm. and it could be very, the individual amounts could be very little. It's marked by hypophosphatemia, which is a low level of phosphorus in the blood, and by volume overload. Like they can get, we can go from dehydration to overhydration. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then the medical complications are that many organ systems can be affected. And the fatalities occur because of cardiac complications, because of this electrolyte abnormality of hypophosphatemia. There's an impact on the contractility of the heart. Mm-hmm. It doesn't pump as well. Mm-hmm. There is congestive heart failure, mm-hmm. and there are rhythm disturbances, which are very typical of people who have electrolyte abnormalities. And seizures can also occur mm-hmm. in these kinds of patients, because again, seizures can occur because of electrolyte issues as well.
And this is all related to treatment.
Can you imagine? You can have this issue and then right. the treatment itself is complicated.
It's complicated. Yeah. It's complicated. Yeah, because I was reviewing the fact that in early starvation that your body is breaking down the fats and protein for energy, and then with mild starvation you have the fats that are continued to be broken down, but then releasing more toxins into the system. And then in advanced starvation, you're breaking down muscles and all kinds of things are happening with your electrolytes
right.
in the system. And
mm-hmm.
then when we come in there and we're trying to fix things, we can also iatrogenically cause problems.
Yes,
you know,
and iatrogenic meaning mm-hmm. physician-created
problems. But the seizures, the coma, the cardiomyopathy, so many things can happen.
Happen, yes.
If we're not careful. But yet, if you're talking to the individual, the insight is lacking with this disorder. So you're talking and nobody's home, and you have to initiate what's best for them and always be very judicious in your treatment.
If you have a patient who is resisting treatment, be it opioid use disorder or mm-hmm. diabetes management mm-hmm. or blood pressure control, it becomes doubly difficult because now they are resisting treatment. Mm-hmm. So that's a very key piece in eating disorders.
Mm-hmm. Very, very key. So the refeeding syndrome is something that we're very aware of, but the cornerstone, as you said earlier, the first thing that must happen is that we need to refeed them.
Yes.
It's almost like the brain does not function well in that starvation mode. They need to be fed, they need to be normalized, and then they'll cooperate with treatment. Until then, they will not cooperate. So aggressively treating the phosphate, potassium, magnesium, all that goes awry, we have to take care of. And then psychotherapy, there's no one approach that seems to be outstanding or stellar in how we approach it. We have to do what that individual needs, whether it's cognitive behavioral therapy, psychodynamic psychotherapy, motivational interviewing. But family therapy for a lot of people is key, because there's so many individuals that come to us with a lot of pathology within the family unit. And so we approach it based on what they need.
Medicine is structured such that we are trained to treat with medication. Mm-hmm. In this situation, though, medications come a lot later on, and they are not as effective.
Mm-hmm. And it also depends, not to cut you off, but it also depends on the comorbid symptom, what comes with the disorder. We treat them if they're anxious, if they're depressed, if they're psychotic, if they're very compulsive and rigid. So it depends on the symptoms they present with, what medications we may have to add initially.
And it's interesting that patients of mine will say that, you know, I knew I was very sick because you are very calm and you don't react, but I could see in your eyes that you were very worried. And so I've developed something from that, you know, I don't want you to worry. The only time you should worry is when I do, and I let you know that. So I remember this patient who had significant anorexia nervosa, and what really stunned me was that she was entirely oblivious. Mm-hmm. She did not see herself as, you know, 75 pounds.
Right.
She just did not see herself like that at all. Mm-hmm. And then I was struggling, like there was no tomorrow, with her low potassium. Mm-hmm. And that low potassium can be so destructive. It can cause death so quickly.
Right.
But she was just completely and totally oblivious. And the involvement, the family is so concerned. But these people are entirely oblivious to what their state is.
And sudden death is a real thing.
Is a real thing.
And in those who have the purging disorders, which you can have anorexic or purge, but you can't really convince them of the gravity of...
Exactly. Yeah. Convincing them is actually the part that can be very frustrating and defeating, because you feel like you're talking to a wall, because you're just not going anywhere with it.
Right.
If it comes to the point, and I think where medications can help is a little bit more in the not acute phase. So when you've stabilized them, and because the disorder is lifelong, it's not something that's curable. It's very treatable.
Very treatable.
But it's not curable. And so because it's lifelong treatment, once you've stabilized them, you might consider medications like olanzapine, also known as Zyprexa. And it's suggested that there should be add-on treatment with olanzapine rather than other medications. We have Abilify, and these medications are typically used in psychosis. And we notice in people who do not have an eating disorder that they cause rapid weight gain, and they are implicated in the development of diabetes because of the significant weight gain that they cause. But with anorexia nervosa, the response may not be as linear or as obvious or direct as it is in people who do not have an eating disorder. An anxiolytic may or may not help. And in the old days, we would use this medication called cyproheptadine or periactin. And if you use that in people who do not have an eating disorder, you make them gain weight very quickly. Cannabinoids, lithium, zinc, omega-3 fatty acids, testosterone, intranasal oxytocin provide little or no benefit compared with placebo. Sadly, our patients get pulled in by the alternative medication, health food store syndrome, I call it. And they spend a whole lot of money on stuff that really doesn't help.
And I'm thinking also of off-label use of a lot of medications that we have available in our arsenal. I have a gentleman right now that I'm working with. I've seen him for over 10 years.
Another gentleman?
I know.
Oh, my goodness. These gentlemen will never go away.
They will never
become patients.
He is a nice young man, and I've I've seen him since he was maybe in his mid-teens, and he's now in his late 20s.
He's in his mid-teens, and calling him a gentleman.
He's still a
gentleman. You know what that means? It means someone who's like 65 years old.
Not in my book.
Yeah, apparently.
So this nice young man, he has OCD. What is curious to me, and I bring him, the relevance of bringing him is that he's been on everything that I could think of for his symptoms, which were stable forever, over 10 more years he was doing well. Now he's not. And so now we have to step outside of the normal courses of products we use to find something different. And I say that to say that for him, he's almost delusional in his behavior. And sometimes I wonder if using Zyprexa and Abilify is because of the thought disorder that occurs that's impaired now in some of these individuals. And so we cannot always explain the rationale for some of the medications we use.
Exactly, yeah.
But we know what works because we have so much experience with them.
And sometimes they do work really
well. Sometimes
they
do work very well. And the Zyprexa is one that works very nicely sometimes in the Abilify. Not just because of the weight gain, but because of adjusting some of the way they think.
Yes.
And the circuitry.
Disordered thought.
It's
really
nice. But there are so many complications, physical complications that come along with this disorder, because we talked about what happens with the electrolyte imbalances and how the body handles starvation. So cardiovascular complications can occur because of that. Not just the rhythm disturbances, but losing muscle mass from your body just consuming any muscle that it finds. Gynecologic issues with amenorrhea. If you don't have your cycle, everything normalizes with refeeding. Well, most things normalizes with refeeding, but you can have problems with that. Endocrine problems with anorexics, having more issues with the hypothalamic issues. Gastroparesis, which is not a fun thing, where your bowels just are not emptying as they should and can cause many other problems. And constipation, which is a major problem if you're not eating. So whatever the body gets, it says, oh, I'm not letting anything go. So it just holds on to everything. So those complicate the picture, which is why, from what you mentioned earlier, it takes a multidisciplinary group to work together to try to take care of some of these symptoms.
Indeed. And the osteoporosis is a reality, because these people, when they are diagnosed, are young.
Yes.
They have a life ahead of them, and it can be full of a lot of complications of fractures because of the osteoporosis.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing with this disorder, and that's why we put it in the addictive disorders, addicted to thinness, is relapse.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a key piece in addiction, that there is treatment and there's stability and then there's relapse.
Mm-hmm.
And this relapse is a very real thing with eating disorders and occurs frequently.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the course of the illness is concerned, there can be success. Approximately 50% have good outcomes, including weight gain. 25% have intermediate outcomes, still struggle. And 25% have a poor outcome, and that's where there is high mortality. And it's associated with increased, we call it all-cause mortality,
mm-hmm.
so not entirely only related to the eating disorder.
Right.
And like we mentioned, suicide deaths are much more common in eating disorders than they are in the general population.
One of the things we try to encourage is to have the individuals commit to staying in counseling, because with stress aggravates everything. But under periods of stress, they may go to what works for them, which is restricting behaviors or purging behaviors. And so if you're committed to counseling, if anything comes up, you have a new, you know, somebody dies, you lose your job, you're getting a divorce, you can go back into counseling and have someone that can walk the journey with you, because stress is not our friend. Yeah, it's not our friend.
Indeed. So I want to talk a little bit about the case histories, so to speak. I really like this one, which illustrates the internal tug of war that these people have. And it's really representative of all of us. We have the two voices in our heads,
mm-hmm.
In which one says one thing and then the other one says the opposite. And then we make the decision. So this patient says that anorexia was like a voice in my head that pretended to be my best friend.
Mm-hmm.
It praised me for skipping meals, for seeing bones, for being cold all the time. Mm-hmm. But it hated me too. It hated when I laughed or felt joy or tried to reach out. So no, notice the hold that it has on the patient. Mm-hmm. Recovery has been learning to recognize that voice and learning to tell it to shut up. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Some days it's a whisper, some days a scream, but it's not me anymore. Mm-hmm. So this is really a happy, happy outcome. And I really love the way that it illustrates, you know, like Pink Floyd said, the voices in our heads.
The voices in our head. And I think also there are those, there's another therapist who shared her experience of the patient who, in keeping up with her her diary of her eating, because in some programs it's important that it is tracked with the patient to ensure that they're taking enough calories and that they're eating enough variety and getting enough of what they need to sustain. But this woman, she said she counted the calories down to a stick of gum.
Lord help
me. A stick of gum. I didn't even know there are calories in gum, so I think
there are, but you have calorie free. I mean,
Yeah, I thought they were mostly sugar free.
Sugar free, yeah. I guess the original ones. Remember Wrigley's? I'm talking about dating us. Yeah, double mint gum. That great ad. Yeah.
I do remember.
The pleasure of double mint gum.
Yeah.
We really hope you found this episode helpful and informative. Our next episode will deal with the other pole of eating disorders, binge eating, overeating, and other less common eating disorders. And we really hope you will join us. I'm your host and producer, Dr. Mahjubeen Islam.
And I am your co-host, Dr. Kathleen Daniels.
And our executive producer is the very talented Chris Pfeiffer. Do share this podcast with friends and family, for it is only through education that our society can be helped and we can stem the destruction that drug use causes and behavioral addictions cause. Just go to wgte.org/treataddiction or wherever you stream your podcasts. And with all the challenges of life, do remember, patience in difficult times and gratitude always. We hope to see you soon.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.